We'd like to take up again this morning some more conversations with Nirsagadatta. And he starts off by saying, go back to that state of pure being, where I am is still in its purity. I wonder, the go back is all right. But of course the truth is we have never left this state of pure being. The thing is that we have become fascinated by our experience. We've been fascinated by, perhaps I should say, the content of our experience. Experience, in a way, is everything. We've learned how to extend our experience through the medium of books, through the medium of videos and cinema and films, television, and more recently YouTube, internet, and all the rest. And the fact that we do extend the range and the complexity and content of our experience just indicates to what extent we are fascinated by it. Indeed, one could say that we are hypnotized by it. And the practice that we're doing is, in a way, to break that hypnotic trance that experience has thrown on us. I corrected myself when saying it's not so much experience, but the content of experience. And what is it then about this content of experience that is so fascinating, which seems to be so enriching? It's an interesting thing that by and large the world's population is now an urban population. People have left the farms and have gone to crowded cities because the stimulus from a variety of different experiences is so attractive. So again, what is it that makes us do this? What makes us seek out experience in this way? And of course, it is because the content of experience is not all that there is. There is the fact of experiencing. There is, if you like, the knowing of experience. Experience is nothing without the knowing experience. There is no experience without there being the knowing of experience. And the variety of experience, particularly in so far as so much of it is discordant, contradictory, This brings about a heightened sense of awareness. It is in the face of trying to make sense of chaos that our awareness is heightened. We feel more alive, we say. There are people that just could not live for any length of time in the country. They would be afraid. They would find the silence too much. They would find the lack of content debilitating. And from this we can draw a lesson that it is not the content of experience itself which is so valuable, which is so necessary. It is this heightened sense of awareness. It's worthwhile mentioning that this heightened sense of awareness is also brought about by danger and risk. If one reads the autobiographies of people who have been through the war, will tell you that during the war they lived intensely as they have never lived before or after. It was worth noticing also that during the London Blitz, the incidence of neurosis dropped considerably. We see people climbing up bare faces of cliffs and rocks and mountains. Because the danger means that they are totally concentrated, totally aware of the moment. It's the same with people that go in for racing cars. In fact, when one looks around, one sees so much of what we do simply as a way of heightening the sense of awareness. Gambling, for example, is another. And what we are doing here is we are going directly to the source. Instead of looking for the stimulus to come from outside, instead of having to have a variety of experience to stimulate that heightened sense of awareness, we're drawing upon our own resources. We are coming alive by ourselves in a way that we are not normally alive. It is this that brings you to Sesshin after Sesshin. This aliveness, this intense awareness indicates that what is true, what is basic, what is real, is awareness. It is not any content. And we've said many times that experience cannot give us happiness, no matter what kind of experience. It's true that we do get a sense of peace sometimes. And it is also, of course, true that we do get this sense of aliveness. But this is not truly happiness so much as stimulation. What this also indicates is this pure sense of being, this pure sense of really its knowing being, knowing which is its own being. This pure knowing being is always present, never absent. Even in sleep, there is still that ongoing knowing being. We say it is ongoing because we mustn't get into the belief that there is a kind of static condition, this substratum, this foundation, this enduring foundation of being, which is called upon by the Vedanta and is also implicit in the Christian tradition, this idea that God, the Supreme Being, is the ground of our being. The idea is that there is something, some continuity, something enduring. But this knowing being that we're referring to is not enduring at all. It has no endurance at all. It does not last in any way or shape or form. And you can see this for yourself. Knowing is not something. It is what is happening. You hear my voice. This is knowing. You feel the pressure of the cushion. This is knowing. You're feeling some sort of feeling or thought. You're having some sort of thought. This is knowing. It's going on. It's changing. It's never stable. It's never steady. It is vibrant. And it is this vibrancy, this ongoingness, which is so essential. Because again, one of the features of experience is our conceptualization. We have to be able to know it as something. And this conceptualization, this knowing it as something, is a way by which we fix experience. We fix it into what we call the world, or the zendo, or the body, or the mind, or even of knowing. We're fixing it all the time. We're turning it into something. Because this enables this experience to have a content. Without that naming, without that fixing, there would be no content. And this, what he says, go back to the source. Awakened to the source. This is what is essential. This sense of the lack of fulfillment that we have, this sense of being somehow alien or lost, the feeling of meaninglessness, the feeling of always being on the go, never resting, always irritated, agitated, and restless. This comes because we've lost contact with what is essential, and we're trying to rediscover it by this kind of stimulation, by trying to heighten the awareness by the drug of experience. He says, where the I am is still in its purity before it became contaminated with I am this or I am that. This is what we mean when we say that we name it, we fix it. I'm not this, I am that. It is that separation, that dualism, which enables us to have the illusion of an enduring world, of a world which is, as we call it, real. And in its own way, it is a miracle. The fact that you can see a Zendo, for example, you take for granted. And yet it is beyond astonishing, beyond amazing, beyond even miraculous. How is that possible? That you can see a Zendo, you can hear a voice, you can understand a voice speaking. How is that possible? It's truly out of this world, if you only give it that, if you only face it in an open way. And this recognition of the wonder of being is only possible when you are grounded in being itself, in knowing being itself. When you are lost in the particulars of experience, it is the resolution of their conflicts, the resolution of the struggle, the pain that is uppermost. It is trying to find something which is stable. And so there can be no wonder in that. And yet a life that has been lived without that wonder is surely a life that has not really been lived. He says, your burden is of false identification, false self-identification. This false self-identification, this claiming to be something, this claiming, I am this or I am that, I'm a man or I'm a woman. This, as we say again, fixes, it deadens. The life has gone out of it. It's like dead skin. He says, my teacher told me, trust me, I tell you, you are divine. Take it as the absolute truth. Your joy is divine, your suffering is divine too. All comes from God. This is an interesting statement coming from one who says the basis of all is I am. And yet he says, your joy is divine, your suffering is divine, all comes from God. You see, This is one of the dangers of Zen practice, and that is that it can drive us into seeing truth as a solipsistic truth, as one that is bound up in the self, as one that is enclosed, you might say, in the prison of self. And this is something that one must struggle with constantly when one is working. You know, solipsism says that everything is simply a product of my consciousness. And no doubt when you were young, you might have played the game with a friend and said to the friend, prove to me that you exist. And whatever the friend said, you say, well, no, that could be my consciousness. That could be my consciousness. And this is something that we must beware of. And this notion that the ground of being is God, that instead of I am, the truth is God is one way in which one can see this as an antidote. You see, it is true that God is, as long as I am identified with something, as long as I believe that I am a man or I'm a woman or I'm a soul or a spirit or a mind or whatever, then this truth, I am the basis of it all, is not true. And we say that one has to earn the right, the authority, if you like, to say that the basis of all is I am. And we mention this because very often in the Dzogchen room, people will come in and say, well, I know that I am, or I'm supposed to know I am, or something, isn't it? And of course, this is the whole trap. You cannot start there. You must see the truth that you believe that you are something. What is most irritating is when you get people playing the game of being awakened. People come into the Dzogchen room and all that they want to show you is that they know what the answer is supposed to be. And we know what the answer is supposed to be. What's the point of coming in and showing what the answer is supposed to be? It's much more important that you struggle to show what you are seeing right now. Not necessarily to the teacher, but to yourself. Because as long as one has this kind of attitude, that feeling that one really ought to be able to say, I am, or ought to be able to give a response to the koan, then one cannot, even on the tan by oneself, really struggle with this. And it is this kind of person that can slip so easily into this narcissistic, solipsistic condition. This, incidentally, is why it is not a good idea to spend too much time practicing on one's own without contact with the teacher. Because it's an easy trap to slip into. There's a mondo with Joshua, in which a monk asked Joshua, what is the basic requirement of a monk? And Joshua says, be honest. And that's it. Without that merciless honesty, then you're simply pulling wool over your own eyes. You're simply continuing in the hypnotic trance. What is there right now? Not what should there be, but what is there? What are you right now? Is the pretense that one can in some way think one's way through this, which is the trap. What are you right now? And if you pursue this, then this will ultimately take you to this state of pure being or state of pure knowing being. It cannot do anything other because you are starting from there. That is your basis. That is what makes it possible for you to see into your own illusions. It's like a touchstone that will divine the truth because it is the truth. Nisargadatta said, I did believe him and soon realized how wonderfully true and accurate were his words. I did not condition my mind by thinking, I am God, I am wonderful, I am beyond. I simply followed his instructions, which was to stay with the pure being I am. This is what is called Shikantaza. And of course, for most people, it is extremely difficult because just staying with the pure being I am can easily lead one into this condition where all that one is doing is looking in the mirror of oneself, seeing oneself in the mirror of oneself. It's sort of awareness of awareness, if you like. And it can indeed give a sense of equanimity and peace. And it does give one the feeling of being secure. But this is the entrance to the solipsism. This is the entrance to this being imprisoned finally inside oneself. This is why we recommend that you stay with the koan. The koan is essentially a condition of doubt. And this condition of doubt is essentially a condition of it is and it is not. In other words, there is that conflict. One sees I am pure being, and yet one sees at the same time, I am not pure being. One sees it because one is it. But one sees that one is not pure being because all of one's experience up to date has been denying that very truth. And so therefore you sit within that dilemma, within that conflict. And this is, of course, the basis of pain. Pain comes because one is divided against oneself. And this is why it is absolutely essential to pass through that pain. But in sitting in that conflicted state that I am and I am not, This is what is called Zazen. He says, there is only one mistake you are making. You take the inner for the outer, and the outer for the inner. What is in you, you take to be outside, and what is outside, you take to be in you. You see, he goes on and explains that. He says, the mind and feelings are external, they're outside, but you take them to be internal. You see, the feeling of anger or anxiety or tension is a feeling. It is something that you are experiencing. And as a consequence, it is outside. You say, I am angry. I am uncomfortable. I hurt. And now you've internalized it. You've made it into what it is not. And so, of course, you cannot work with it. This is why, if you sit and allow, anxiety to arise, sooner or later, you will see it is not I am anxious, but there is anxiety, which is a completely different experience. I am anxious means the anxiety takes on the absoluteness, which is your birthright. You are absolute, is what he said up there before. I am is absolute. That is indubitable. That is beyond all cause and effect. I am is I am, and there's nothing that brings it about, and nothing can take it away. And this is why it is said, I am absolute. But at the same time, if I say I am angry, the anger now becomes absolute as well. It takes on a new kind of reality. And it is that reality which makes anger so difficult to work with, or anxiety makes it so difficult to work with. And this is why, if one can stay with it, allow it to be, it will no longer, you'll no longer be identified with it. And then you'll see it as a feeling. And as a feeling, it is no longer absolute, because feelings come and go, changes constantly. And so therefore you are freed from it, or rather you are freed from it as an absolute condition. And it's worthwhile spending some time looking at this, what I'm saying now. Because you will find that this is the dominating feature of negative emotions. That one takes them as one's own being. And because of that, they take on this overwhelming kind of attribute. They become somehow impenetrable. They take on a reality, almost a kind of permanence. One feels this is how it is always going to be. And this is why it is so important that one works with them in the way that we've suggested time and time and time again. It will break that spell. And you take for outside what is inside. And this is what we were saying yesterday when we ended the Taisho by saying, you are experience. There is not you, the Zendo, and experiencing the Zendo. This is not how it is. This is how you could describe it. This is what happens when you freeze it with the magic of words. But if you look at it as is, innocently, you might say, naively, without any preconceptions or prejudices, then it is just experience. And you pass your whole day like this, really. The problem is that the content is dominant. And the awareness of the content is passive. But the awareness and the content are like a vase and the form. You cannot separate them, but they're not the same. The clay and the form, these are not the same. Clay is clay and the form is form. But you cannot separate them in the vase. And in the same way, you cannot separate awareness and content of awareness. Emptiness is form. Form is emptiness. But they're not the same. He says that you believe the world to be objective while it is entirely a projection of your psyche. Well, the idea of a projection, that we project the world, that doesn't work. Because that will make us sort of tend to become more of solipsistic, more of the idea that it's simply my consciousness. Now, what the world is, we can describe. But that the world is, we cannot describe. Just in the same way that what I am, I can talk about. But that I am, I just cannot talk about. And to make one subservient of the other, to make the world, that the world is, a projection of that I am, is a grave mistake. Just in the same way that, as the scientists would have it, that to say that I am is dependent on that it is, or the world, or matter, or whatever, is also a grave mistake. We have here the profound mystery, and one must recognize this. Everything cannot be brought within the aegis of understanding. This is not possible. And it is that having that humility to recognize that we are in the face of a profound mystery in terms of what we call the world, that is again the outcome of our practice. We must see the limits of our understanding. You must come to terms with this. And you don't have to be a great philosopher to fail to see that understanding has its limits. Everyone has their own understanding of the world. Everyone is a metaphysician. But some people, their metaphysics has become refined. But most people, most of us, it is just in a very crude fashion. He says that is the basic confusion. He says, pay attention to your thoughts in the same way that you watch the street traffic. You see, people get very worried because they've got what they call all these thoughts. They come and they say, well, my mind is all over the place. And the first thing that you must do is detach yourself from the thoughts. They are not my thoughts. This is the first step. Just in the same way, it is not my people or my traffic that travel along St. Catherine Street. We allow it to be. We are detached from it. And one does this in exactly the same way as one becomes detached or non-identified with our feelings. You allow the thoughts to be. And you can do this. But to allow the thoughts to be, you have to be willing to know the source or the cause of these thoughts. And this is always some acute discomfort, some pain, in fact, some anguish. It can be extreme humiliation. And this can be, as you sit there, there can arise within you the feeling of extreme humiliation. And you are not aware of this because the thoughts come up in order to somehow deal with that humiliation. And you spend the time pursuing the thoughts, trying to do something about the thoughts. But always you can take it as a rule. Always, when you are burdened by thoughts, underlying those thoughts is some kind of unpleasant feeling. And it takes a while to allow oneself to settle down to the point where that uncomfortable feeling becomes manifest, becomes available. But if you spend your time trying to hold the mind steady so that it is not taken up by thoughts, if you try to impose some kind of artificial mind state on the mind, some Zen mind state, concentrated, focused, aware, or whatever you might call it, then, of course, you're just blocking everything out. You're just, now I've got one supreme thought I must not think. But if you can just relax, let the tension come up, let the discomfort rise, then you'll find that the thoughts become more like ghosts. They've got no real solidity. And then you can pay attention to your thoughts as you watch the traffic. He says, people come and go. You register without response. And you register without response because you're no longer identified. It's no longer my thoughts. He says, it may not be easy in the beginning, but with some practice, you will find that your mind can function on many levels at the same time, and you can be aware of them all. And this is what we're saying, because underlying the thoughts is the unpleasant experience. But underlying the unpleasant experience is what we've been calling pure knowing being. And as he says, it is possible to operate on all levels. There are intermediary levels between those as well. You get the level of thoughts, and then you'll get a level of sort of primary thought, which says, I've got to do something about this. And if you can switch into that as well, because that will help you get into the pain, the discomfort. But this is how you can start using the force of your adversary, which is this restless mind, in such a way that it becomes working not against the adversary, but with the adversary. You're no longer in a state of opposition, but you are now in a state of cooperation. You're working with what is going on with the mind, and you're no longer working against it. And once you've got into that kind of thing, then it doesn't matter what comes up. It truly doesn't matter what comes up, because you're working with it. It's now part of the whole refining process. It says, only when you have a vested interest in any particular level that your attention gets caught in it and you black out on other levels. And you could say that this is what we're working towards, because one of the things that people seem to feel is that they should ultimately get into a state whereby they are always in pure being. They believe that this is the ultimate, that they will leave behind the world of experience, the world of phenomena, that they'll somehow be able to live in a kind of purity. But this is not only impossible, but it's highly undesirable. There is nothing at all wrong with living in the world. There's nothing at all wrong with enjoying living in the world, enjoying the relations with other people, enjoying the successes and failures, enjoying the whole process of life, becoming one with all of the ups and downs of life. And life has got as many downs as it's got ups. And one lives with that. It's okay to feel sad. It's okay to feel depressed. It's okay to feel ill. In other words, it's not, well, something's wrong with my practice. I'm feeling sad today, so what have I done wrong? When am I going to get this clear? How long does it take to get a real result from my practice? As long as one has this feeling that there is this ultimate state of purity, then everything will be no good. Everything will be pointless. Nothing will have any kind of value at all, which is quite the opposite to what our practice is about. Our practice is about everything having value, everything being important. Nothing lies outside.
Four vows.
All beings without number, I
vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions I vow to uproot. Dharma gaze beyond measure I vow to penetrate. The great way of Buddha I vow to attain. All beings without number I vow to liberate. Endless blind passions I vow to uproot. Dharma gaze beyond measure I vow to the great way of Buddha I vow to attain.